this a, can you hear me? Yes. Is a, do you, do, does this only affect the recording, or yeah. is there a...
there's a little bit of sound that comes out.
There's a little bit, right? Yeah. Okay. Now, time flies. Of course, I wanted to do as usual much more than I am doing. So let's try to use at best this final lectures. I want to do three things. So one is to, so we got to the point in which the theory has been written down. I want to make several comments about that to give you a better understanding of what it is, how it works, and what are the results that what we know about this this theory. That's one thing, and it will be done today. I want to talk about the kind of calculation that one can do with that, and that will be sketchy because I don't have time to sort of go in details and compute stuff. It's all in the literature, what has been computed. So I will just give you some hints of how it works and how to go with this. And third thing, I would like to leave a little bit of space open for you to come up with questions and things you want to know, just not to fill everything with material, which I think is best to reserve for the last lecture, which is tomorrow. So tomorrow will take half an hour or more. So please come with general questions and what you think is it's you haven't understood, and especially somehow what remains open in your mind about to which extent this is a theory of quantum gravity is not, and what can do with it. So for the moment, this is lecture 13. Whoops. Hi. Oh, this is lecture 13. And so, full theory. Properties and else. There's some detail in the definition that I've skipped, which I have to fill in. It's a technical detail, but I don't want to give you a formula which is wrong, so I want to correct it and talk about extension and talk about what we know about this and why we think is interesting. So let me summarize everything. So the theory, as I've defined it, is given as follows. There is a Hilbert space attached to an arbitrary graph, which we have written many times. So it's SU2 to the number of links divided by SU2 to the number of nodes, where the action of this is given by the topology, the combinatorial structure of gamma. This only depends on the combinatorial structure of gamma. On this Hilbert space, we have operators. I use the notation that Eugenio used, which is probably clear. So we have one E operator to each oriented link of the graph. It's good to have E, so you can just put dimension in 8 pi H bar G gamma L, where L is the left invariant vector fields, the derivative in the algebra acting on the L group element in the state. So this is the basic operator, sort of the tetrad operator, the triad operator in some sense. The out of this you can construct GL L prime every time you have a node with a link L and an L prime oriented that way. All this arranges itself nicely if you have links oriented the other way, but it just doesn't it's just useless technical complication. You can always think that things are oriented outside. This is just the scalar product in R3 in the Lie algebra of two of these. And if you take L equal L prime, so the norm of that, the square root of the diagonal element of this matrix here. This is AL, so this thing here is interpreted as the area of the sort of little tetradium of the face of the little tetradium cut by that edge there. And the volume, right, the volume square is associated to a node. This is associated to a link. This doesn't depend on the orientation. The volume is associated to a node. So the volume square, it's 4 over 9 E1, E2, E3, the triple product, where E is 1, 2, 3, or any one of this. And this doesn't depend on the one chosen because of the gauge invariance of the node, because we're in this Hilbert space here. Now, this operator here and this these operator here for all L and this operator here for all N form, we have proven that a commuting set of operators in sense of Dirac. So a basis, I put gamma just to remember that I'm that Hilbert space there, is given by these things here, where these are the quantum numbers, if you want, of area and volume. And this is called the spin network basis. Spin network basis. And out of this structure, you can do all the geometry of the quantum geometry, quantum 3D geometry. You can compute coherent states. You can describe standard Riemannian three-dimensional geometry on the large scale, which when you go down into small is discrete and fuzzy and quantized. Then I've defined a amplitude W, which depends on a two complex, which I call C, and is a function of the group elements on the link of the graph that bounds the two complex, and is defined as the integral over SU2, or many copies of SU2, of a group element associated to every vertex face of these two complex. The product on the faces of delta of all the h, the product of all the h around the face, let me write it explicitly this time, the product on the vertices around the face, okay, of hvf, and then the product on the vertices of a vertex amplitude. Vertex amplitudes depend on the all the hv with the same v, so hvf, where the vertex amplitude, these all formulas that you have already. So I just put the face because the vertex is here. So all the faces around is given by an integral on SL2C, DGE, one per each edge. So there are five of these. This is the vertex. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and all the faces around. So these are the edges. These are the faces, the 10 faces around, of the product on the face. I write it this way. Sum over j, dj, and then the trace in the j representation of hf, y dagger, ge, ge minus 1, y, where the group element here means the matrix element corresponding to it in the appropriate representation. And Y, finally, it's a map from Hj to Hpk, where P is gamma J plus 1 and K equals J, and is explicitly given by Jm going into PK, so I'm going to write explicitly, gamma J plus 1 Jn. So this is the theory. This is sort of the kinematics. And this is the dynamics. It's just names, these things. And this is the object we are discussing. Now, a certain number of comments and corrections. Let me immediately do a little correction to that, because in fact, there's a little mistake there, a little technical mistake, which I'll correct immediately. And look, if you were smart enough, you would catch it, but quite smart. Look at the amplitude. The amplitude is an integral on dg e, five copies of this. So in SL to C to the five, okay, five group elements of a function, which is a function of all these five elements, but this function of all these five elements, in fact, is just a function of the products GE, GE prime minus one. So E, E prime, et cetera, is just a function of a product, the group element here, minus one, for all possible couples of that. Now, okay, so what? Well, a function that has this property is invariant under a common gauge transformations of all the GE. So if I take all of GE and I send them, each one of them, in GE lambda, well, lambda is an SL2C element, pretty obviously this does not change, because I put a lambda here and a lambda minus one that goes on this side and cancel. So it's invariant under that. So in this five-dimensional, in this five times six-dimensional space of on which the integration is defined, there are an SL2C worth of dimensions, six dimensions, in which this is constant. Okay. Which also means that if you only integrate in four of these, the result is invariant under the action of the fifth integral. Is that obvious to everybody, or do you want me to show that? Okay? If you are in if you are in R3 and you're integrating dx, dy, dz, okay, how do you do that? And you're integrating a function of 2 points, but your function only depends on the differences, okay? Then there is a common action of the R3 group on everything, which makes a function invariant. So once you integrate in one, the function only depends on the difference. So there is a redundancy, which is the integration on the sum, okay? So it's exactly the same thing happened here. So these are two consequences. So first, you can free of charge drop, so two consequences. First, you can drop one of these integrals. If you just integrate on SL to C to the four, dg1, dg4, and not the fifth one, in fact, you're doing the same thing. You can go from a change of variables, which is in fact, GE for E 1 to 4 into GE G5 minus 1, which takes this into this thing into this. So if you integrate this on G E1, E4, and last the identity, you can go from here to here to change your variable. And the second consequence, which is why I'm doing all that, is that this integral obviously diverges, right? Because after you're done the fourth integration, when you do the fifth integration, you get an infinity, which is the volume of SL2C. SL2C is non-compact. So the Hare measure, when you integrate it, the invariant measure, you get an infinity, okay? So as I've written there, there is an infinity. There's a bad infinity in each one of these amplitudes here. Okay, which is ugly and nonsense. On the other hand, there is a completely, so as it is written, A is infinite. Okay. But all the discussion shows that this is a stupid infinity and is immediate to take it out. You just don't integrate in all the five variables, you integrate in all four of them. It doesn't matter which, because the thing is invariant. So let me correct. And here I'm only integrate on four of these, and I just put a prime, meaning that I'm integrating on not all of them, all minus one. Okay. And if one does that, it's not obvious, but it has been shown by some Polish guys in Warsaw that with this correction, AV, properly corrected, is finite. Okay, so there's no further divergence. That was the first comment. Now, the second comment is that, well, let's put this. Oh. I don't need that one. The second comment is that, in fact, it's more than a comment. Let me complete this discussion up there. I've defined for a given graph and a given two complex. Okay? But in fact, we want any arbitrary graph, any arbitrary two complex in the theory. The theory is not defined on any one of that. So let me define the full LQG, all graph and all comments. How does one think about that? Well, let me give you the simplest way of thinking about that. Think about QD. In QD, in perturbation theory in QD, when standard, the one is used at CERN to compute stuff. The theory is defined as Fock space. How do you build a Fock space? Well, so the theory in QD, or just think Maxwell theory, quantum Maxwell theory is easier. No, let's think QD. Don't do dynamics for the moment. So the theory is defined on the Fock space. The Hilbert space is the Fock space. How is it defined? Well, first you define a one-particle Hilbert space. That's one way of doing it. R4 with, so on the hyperboloid, for instance, dp, delta p square m square, and I guess I want also dp 0. So that's a standard one-particle, relativistic one-particle Hilbert space. Then you define the n-particle Hilbert space, hn, by just taking a certain number of this and tensoring it. Okay. And if the, let's do the bosonic part, you just take the symmetric tensor product. Okay. Let's do, think about photons. That's why I hesitated there. and this is the space with n particles. Now, if you want just to consider the theory up to n particles, you can define a space, which is the sum with n going from 0, because you want the vacuum, to n of this hn. So this is a state with either one particle, two particle, three particle, up to n, right? And then Fock space is defined as the limit of this for n going to infinity. So Fock space is the limit with n going to infinity of hn. Meaning what? Meaning that you take all possible states with an arbitrary number, with an arbitrary finite number of particles in it, right? Now here, the structure is very similar. So the one particle in the space is the...
What's the zero particle?
The vacuum.
Do you define it as something, or do you...
See. Zero, this is zero, H zero is the C. Because is a vacuum state multiplied by any arbitrary complex number in front of it. So it's still, it's a ray on C because it's quantum mechanics, which is one state. Right, a generic state, it's some combination of the vacuum plus some combination of P, okay, plus some combination of P1, P2, plus so on and so forth. So here you have to integrate in d3p f of p. Here you have to integrate in dp1 dp2 f of p1 p2. Okay. So this sits on the 0, this sits on the 1, this sits on the 2. And the Fock space is an arbitrary combination of that that converges. All right. So here we have exactly the same structure. The one particle in the space corresponds to the space on a node, k. On the node, okay. This is like one quantum, and the Hilbert space on a graph, you remember, can be written as a tensor product on the node of the Hilbert spaces on each node. So it's like a Hilbert space of n particles. N nodes is like n particles, okay. But then look, suppose you have a graph, gamma. Yes, and you choose a subgraph, this, or just this. Just take away one line, and you call gamma prime the subgraph. Well, you could think something more complicated. Okay, so let me say that gamma prime is a subgraph of gamma. Then, obviously, in H gamma, there is a linear subset, a Hilbert space subspace, such which I call gamma prime, which is formed by all the functions. Remember, in this space here, the functions that depend on the U attached or all the links. So let me define this as the space of functions that are independent from this U here. Okay. Then obviously it's the same space as this one. And in the Fourier representation, if it is independent from this, it means it sits in the zero representation. So it has spin zero on this line here. So the state with spin zero here, which are the state which are independent of the U attached to this, form a subspace, which is the Hilbert space of that. So if you make the graph larger, you're essentially enlarging the Hilbert space, and you obviously want to identify the theory defined on this graph here, the state of the theory defined on this graph here, as a subset of the states defined here, which have spin zero there, which are independent there. Okay. So H gamma, in fact, can be written as a sum over all the subspaces gamma prime of gamma of Hilbert spaces gamma prime, where now I put a tilde because I consider J different from zero, all the states different from zero. So all the states here, I can view them, the ones with a spin different from zero, genuinely here, the one which is here is spin zero, as living on this space here. So my space here can be thought as a sum of spaces. So Hilbert space on a graph is really like this object here. It's like the Hilbert space up to n particles, some of which might not be there. Some spins might not be there. So finally, it's obvious what you want to do. You want to define a Hilbert space as a limit of gamma going to infinity of H gamma, meaning what? Meaning that this is a sum of all possible gamma of the Hilbert spaces with that sit on that gamma and do not have zero spins. Okay, so I'm simply saying that the full theory is defined on this basis of state for JL is different from zero, and these are all my states, period, in the full theory. Okay? So this is a new equation, if you want. Now, this is to, in a sense, to make mathematicians happy. But if you think for a moment, Fock space is just sitting there to make mathematicians happy. Because if you're at CERN and you deal with particle physics and you use QED, you never work in Fock space. You always work in a truncation of the theory with a finite number of particles. Okay, because you find a number of incoming particles in your process, a finite number of outgoing particles in the process, and when you compute transition amplitudes, you go up to certain order in perturbation theory. And up to certain order in perturbation theory, you have only particles up to a certain number, of, right? Because each vertex creates at most finite number of particles. So if you have to some order, your full calculation are always in this space, never in the limit. So very fine, we can write Fock space, but if we don't, and we just work with QED with HN, being sure that when we want sufficient precision, we can just take N sufficiently large, we have QED. We can compute everything that can be computed in perturbative QED. So the same is here. We can define the space to be fancy. In fact, one can do fancier mathematical definitions. But in reality, we always work with some graph. And if we want a better approximation, we work to a finer graph. And that's it. Okay. The same. I've used this one. Went the wrong way. The same is true for the for the two complex. What has been defined there is WC. WC, defined there, okay, is a function of HL. So in fact, is an element of the Hilbert space attached to the graph, which is the boundary of C. Okay? It's an element of the Hilbert space and it's on its boundary graph. Now, what we want in the full theory, somehow, is to consider an arbitrary fine graph inside. The more you refine the graph, the more you approximate the correct transition amplitude. So what we want is something which still depends on those variables, but doesn't depend on the specific graph chosen or the specific two complex chosen, but only by gamma. So let me call gamma delta C. We want something that, given a graph, gives the amplitude inside. And this is what? This is somehow the limit for C going to infinity of WC of HL on all the C such that its boundary is gamma. What is the meaning of that limit? What is the limit for refining a graph? Well, it's perfectly well defined. The notion of limit is perfectly well defined. Doesn't mean that it converges. Because two complexes also, you can write a sub two complex. If you have a two complex, C, a sub two complex C prime is just something you take some of the faces away, possibly some of the edges away, possibly some of the vertices away, and you get another two complex. So it's a well-defined notion of two complex. So a notion of limit in that case is well defined. I say that the limit C going to infinity of some function of C, well, let me let me do it explicitly for that. I say that the limit of C going to infinity of WC is W if for all epsilon there is a C such that this such that WC minus W is less than epsilon for all C which are larger than C bar. Right? So to have a well-defined notion of limits, essentially you just need an order relation. In fact, for this to make sense, you need a little bit more, but this is satisfied by that. You need that given any two objects in your order relation, there is a third one which is larger than both. So then you can play this game for anyone. But this is true for graphs. Okay. So this is the most general notion of limit you can find. It's called filters and fancy mathematical names of that, stuff. Okay? So it makes sense, which doesn't mean that we know the things converges, of course. But we don't know it converges even for QED, right? We don't know whether sum of all perturbation, all Feynman graphs converges in QED, much less we know here. We hope it would, but we don't. For the moment, there's no idea whatsoever.
Question.
Yes?
On the left hand side, what's E and what's C?
Sorry. No, they all C. They're all two complexes. It's my horrible notation. We have a notion of a two complex being a sub two complex, another one. The limit for the two complex going to infinity, or something defining of a two complex, is defined as follows. We say that this is a limit of that. If for every epsilon there is a two complex, such that every two complex higher than that, more complex than that, is it's different. Its W is different from this number up to epsilon. So the standard Noether's limit, where standard notion of a limit of something going to infinity, where instead of going to infinity, you have more and more complex. More. Okay. Good. So this is the new equation. So now we have this not just, we can think about this not just on a single two complex set graph, but on anything. We know how to refine it. We have more to say about that. In fact, I do want to say something a little bit more without going in any detail. This can also be written. Let me just mention it very rapidly. Also in a two complex, the amplitude of two complex, remember, is a sum over JF. I'm going to go back to this expression more in detail, of some amplitude of C with JF. Well, this is a spin associated to a phasis. So you can still, when you have a very refined complex, you can still define a W like you did there, W tilde, not summing of all the spin from 0 to infinity, but summing only on the spin from 1 to infinity, AC of JF. So take away all the cases, all the contribution when you have zero spin. But the contribution of zero spin, you can view them as is they were defined on a smaller two complex. So this limit here, in fact, you can also write as a sum on two complexes, where this is the amplitude of a two complex obtained by summing only on the spin different from zero. So So you can review this limit, rethink this limit as a sum, where you only consider the terms without spin zero, and then you sum more and more complicated thing, separating away the spin zero components. Sorry? Oh, sorry, 1/2, thanks. Thank you very much. Now, let's go a little bit more detail. 1, 2, 3. I have that definition there is all in terms of group elements. But of course, I can completely go to a representation where I just have, I can Fourier transform that and go complete in spin and intertwiners. And in fact, it's a little calculation. It's exactly the one I did in three dimensions. It's not at all complicated. And not sure I want to do it because it will take some time. So let me just give you the result. I can write that amplitude there, WC, and it's Fourier transform, so it's defined on the boundary Hilbert space, so I can write it in the basis JLVN, links and nodes. And not surprisingly, it's going to be given by a sum over spins attached to faces and intertwiners. Intertwiners, so V attached to edges of the product on F of DJF and the product of a vertex amplitude. Well, now the vertex amplitude is a function of the spin of the on the faces and the intertwiners on the edges, which are, you know, on the graph so this is a vertex, this is an edge, this is a face on the graph gamma V, which I've defined, which sits around the node. Okay. Is C, they all C's. Yes, you're right. So this is C, this is a link. The link on the boundary graph. Okay, this is a two complex.
So what was the difference of this definition from the previous one?
From that one? No, it's the same object. I'm just writing it explicitly. What it is. And in fact, you see that it is a sum over spins. It happens to be a sum of spins. Now, if you write this explicitly, this is the Fourier transform of the of that vertex amplitude there. Right? If you write it explicitly what it is, it's very simple. It's so a function of J sitting here and the intertwiners sitting here. So let me write J links and intertwiners on the nodes. You take the spin network state corresponding to this, so JLIN. This is an SU2 spin network state. Now, with a map Y, you can map SU2 function in SL2C functions because if you know how to map representation, any function of SU2 can be expanded in representation matrices, which have indices in the representation, okay? So which sits in HJ tensor HJ. So if you can map representation, you can map this too. So in other words, the map Y gamma can be used to map a function of SU2 into a function of SL2C. Let me use H here. How? Well, you can decompose this in a matrix element, M, N prime. So this is a basis there. So if you know how to map this, you can know how to map anything. And this you know how to map. You just send this into gamma j plus 1 j, j m prime of g. So this is a function of SE2, this is a function of SL2C. You know how to map this, so you know how to map any function there. So you take this network function, you map it up with y, and then you take you have a function in is a Spinetto function, but is not gauge invariant on SL2C. So you project on the SL2C invariant part by integrating on the nodes. You compute it on the identity, because at the end, they're all the delta functions. And that's exactly what you get here. Okay. So the amplitude can be viewed as a sum over the amplitude on a given two complex can be viewed as a sum of spins and intertwiners of this amplitude of the two complex colored with spin and intertwiners. And the full amplitude, let me just sketch it, without C, can be viewed as a sum over all the two complexes bounded by the boundary state in which you want, so such that its boundary is gamma, of a sum over spins and intertwiners, this on faces, this on edges, of this thing here, which is an amplitude which depend on the two complex, its spins and intertwiners. This is called a spin form. This is what is a spin form. Just one word. So a spin form is a two complex with spins on faces and intertwined on edges. And it has an amplitude, which is given by these two formulas. And the transition amplitude, you're supposed to sum over all possible spin two complexes of with all possible color, with all possible spin, or all possible two corners. And now, this is pretty because it gives you a different way of thinking about that. And this now it starts to become a little bit more interesting. Which is the way here in PI, Lee Smalling thinks about all that. The states of the theory are just things like that. Forget everything else. Okay? So state of the theory is something with some j here and some v and some v here. And if you want to compute transition amplitude between that, you have to put this spin forms, but the spin form, you can view it as a history of that. Okay, let me give you an example. Suppose you have this initial state, and you want to evolve to that final state. Then you want two complex in the middle, okay? So you put a cylinder here, and this is something that cuts the cylinder. At some point here, something happens. There's a vertex, which splits in three, one, two, and three. So now you have, and this goes up like that. So you have one face that goes like that. The face is around, and then this face here, and this face here in the back. So the vertex is something that happens at one vertex, where one vertex, which was in that case a trivalent vertex, evolves into three. And if you do the same in four dimensions, which is, if you think that this was a four-valent one, and this is a dual of a four-simplex, you have a four-valent vertex, which evolves into that. These are called elementary moves. So the idea is that you have these states, and evolution in coordinate time, is given by this elementary move, which have an amplitude, the amplitude being that one. Just compute the probability of this to happen. And the probability transition of going from this state to this state is summing of all possible histories that goes from one to the other with these elementary moves with this amplitude. So a spin form is a history of spin network. Spin form is a history of spin networks. Next comment. I don't know where I am with the numbers. 3, 4. Once you think in these terms, who cares about triangulations? After all this is defined in terms of graphs and two complexes. I've introduced everything as dual to triangulations. But there's nothing here that says that there should be a triangulation. In fact, those equations are perfectly well defined for any graph and any two complex. So it's natural, and it might be done. And a lot of people think in this way, to just forget triangulations. And consider all possible graph and all possible two complexes. Which means that the graph does not necessarily need to be four-valent. Not necessarily a tetrahedron, a node. And the two complex does not necessarily have a vertex with five things, not necessarily a dual of a four simplex. And if you look at those equations, they perfectly work. There's nothing that requires the graph to be four valent. Everything goes exactly through except one detail, the volume. Okay? So if you have a node, now it can be n-valent, and it's not a tetrahedron anymore. The area still, you can think this is a chunk of space, touched another chunk of space, there's a surface in between it, that area. Okay, but how to think about that geometrically? Well, you can still think about that geometrically because you still have all the EL here. They still satisfy the closure, so the sum over E. L is zero. And there's a little theorem which is due to Minkowski that says that once you have that, this quantity defines uniquely a polyhedron. So a figure, not very good in drawing. Think of a dodecahedron, where the number of faces correspond to the number of this, and this E you have to think now as normals. Okay, so the angles are before, the faces are before, and now you can have a polyhedron with n faces, so there's a formula for the volume. So now you have to use the formula of that for the volume. If you are. All the rest go through. Or, and this is 6, alternatively, just take the geometrical interpretation seriously with the triangulation. And look, let me do it now, just a little bit carefully. The transition ampli, let me just take no boundary, so just a partition function. I've written it as dh on vf, product on the faces of delta h f v h f v1 vn, and then the product on the vertex of dg ve, and then the product on the faces, not to get confused, like this is the product on the face in that vertex, sum of jf, let me put a v just to remember that is not that same f as there, of the djvf, and then here I have a trace of hvf y dagger e ve, sorry, gve g minus 1 ve prime y. Okay? So that's a full amplitude. But look, it's easy to do this integral. Because this is a delta, so as usual, I can expand it. Sum over jf of djf, and here trace jf. And now I have each one of these integration variables appears only twice, once here and once there. So I can just do this integral easily. So I do all this. I get rid of all this. And what do I get? Get rid of all this. What do I get? They have to be in the same representation. So the sum of a j goes out, jf, and all the f which were from all the vertices around that face, now they are forced to be in the same representation as jf. So this disappears. The d just one of them disappears from the integral of the two things, and what remains is the integral of all the d g v e. This is all gone, and then the product on the faces, and here I have all these little pieces remaining, sort of glued around the face, which goes here. So the trace J F of Y dagger G G minus 1 Y dagger G G minus 1 etc. around the face. Okay? So this is SL2C. I go down to SU2. I go up again. Okay? So here I am in SU2. I can insert a sum over m of jm jm, a resolution of identity, or equivalently, Eugenio has done the current states, the current state form a basis, jn n jn. And I can insert one for each face and for each edge around the face, which sits here. So I want one of these for each face and for each edge around the face. Face, edge. Face, edge. And then this breaks up. And becomes a sum of the spins, an integral over directions, sum of spin attached to faces, an integral of a direction to each face and edge, these ones here, an integral over dg ve, and then the product over faces and a couple of edges, so vertices, of jn y dagger g minus 1, y j n, where this is on the face
and this is face edge. This is edge, edge prime, face, edge prime. So now think of the triangulation. This is a discretization of the connection. This is a discretization of the triad. So you have your, let's see, if you see what's going on. We have your our four simplices here. Okay, four simplex. Around it, there are the tetrahedra. Okay, so there's one tetrahedron here, so the one tetrahedron here, one tetrahedron here, one tetrahedron here. And one tetrahedron there, five. If you have a triad, you have an area associated to each face and a normal associated to each face, which you can write. So each we are in four-dimensional space now. So each tetrahedron here defines a Lorentz frame because it's a three-dimensional object, so the normal. In this Lorentz frame, there is a vector which is normal to that. So we're integrating on these vectors and these areas, which are the geometry of the tetrahedra. And these are group elements that take you from the center of four simplex to each one of these, okay, from the vertex to the edge. Some amplitude, which for each vertex is a product on all the faces around of this matrix element here. So we're really doing a discretized version of the path integral of some product on the vertex of something, a vertex amplitude. Okay. So it's a discretized version of some product of the face of those exponent of some sum of the points, which is an integral of some Lagrangian. That's what we're doing, discretized. And here it's clear what happens. Is I have this triangle. This is a triangle, a spin and oriented. And I know how to view it in an SL2C representation. This gives me the Lorentz transformation. The four-dimensional Lorentz transformation. This is this other, this is the same face, but viewed in this frame here. So I have the Lorentz transformation from here to here and here, which turns these two triangles together and bring them together. Now, why I'm doing all that? Because finally, and that's the end of the story, I can give all the main results. The main result, which is that if I have one four simplex, this data gives me a boundary geometry, right? A boundary geometry, and I can think of this as boundary geometry for simplex, and these are connection that go from here, and to here, so from here to here. Now, for j much larger than 1, so when this j is large, this integral here can be studied by using a subtle point method, because this can be written as an exponential of something, and j comes in front of it. And it's a rather delicate calculation, but the result is the following, that the subtle point picks up the g's, which are exactly the g's needed to take this five tetrahedra, which are in R3, and turn them so that they glue together in a four simplex. Okay, so the g's are picked up by the subtle point equations to be the correct geometrical transformation that glue them together. Okay, so subtle point analysis G's are determined, all the GEV are determined by the spin and the normals, okay? And are determined in such a way that these sort of glue together to make a geometry. And second, a subtle point, give an expression for this quantity. So for the sort of, so I can write it as a product on the vertex of vertex amplitude, which is a product of the faces of this thing here. And this polar J is the exponent of the I, the regi action, plus e to the minus I, the regi action. What is the meaning of the regi action? Well, I have a geometry. I have a four simplex with geometrical data on the boundary. So I can compute in this four simplex the length of these bonds. The length of this bond now give me the data for writing the regi action of that. And that's exactly what comes out from the syntautical analysis. So in other words, this thing here is a discretization of e to the I, e with g, with f star. Why I get two terms? Well, I get two terms because the regi action only depends on the length, okay? While this thing here depends on the triad. But given the same geometry, I have two triads that do the same job, the one oriented in one way, the one oriented in the other way. So on each point, if you want, this formally, this on each point, some, if I compare it with this, this on each point sum of two configuration, which translate in the discrete that on each vertex, I get two configuration, which are exactly the regi action with a plus and the regi action with a minus, because this flip sign when I change the negative orientation. So all this construction, in fact, and that's bottom line, that justifies all this, otherwise it would just be useless construction, is a discretization of the path integral. So it is a discretization of the path integral. It is a structure where on the small there's a Planck scale discreteness. It is what we wanted. And in fact, and I just mentioned that without going to this, the transition for amplitudes are ultraviolet finite. So there's no divergence corresponding to the. And to be more precise, if I replace SL2C, and I just mentioned that, with SL2C Q, so quantum deformation, quantum group. These are recent results. I get Q deformed transition amplitudes, and I get two results. First, these are finite. And second, analogous to that, the corresponding Q deformed amplitude goes as e to the I s r with a cosmological constant plus e to the minus I s reg with a cosmological constant. So with the Q deformation, which fortunately I didn't have time to go into, the theory is finite. Q deformation cuts up the large J divergences, and the theory is exactly finite. I guess I'll stop here, and tomorrow I will spend 20 minutes, no more, giving you an overview of what one do with that, what kind of calculation can be actually done. And then I'll leave you space for questions for everything. Okay. So the bottom line of the story is that there's a well-defined theory. It's finite. It is a discretization of the functional integral that Charles Meissner wrote formally 50 years ago, but and it's a tentative theory of quantum gravity. See you tomorrow. Come with questions. Don't hesitate. Deep questions, silly questions, all sorts of questions.